Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. Today, we are spending the hour with Lisa Graves, who's out with a new book called Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. Lisa Graves knows John Roberts well. In 2002, as part of her work for the Senate's Judiciary Committee, one of her first tasks was to evaluate Roberts, whom George W. Bush had nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Lisa Graves writes, "This book explains how John Roberts ascended to the Supreme Court and for nearly two decades maintained a reputation as a fair referee, despite using the court to advance a reactionary political revolution in the law to undo widely popular policies. It details the network of billionaire-funded groups engaged in a radical crusade to remake American society through the courts and shows how Roberts is both a cause and a consequence of their efforts." Lisa Graves goes on to write, "Most people really have no idea who Roberts is, what a destructive force he is to American jurisprudence, and how he has helped fracture our political system and our society." Lisa Graves is an expert on the right-wing influence on the Supreme Court and other levers of power. She leads True North Research and is co-host of Legal AF. She served as senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, including as chief counsel for nominations for the Senate Judiciary Committee for Senator Patrick Leahy. Her new book is called Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. And if you're in the Bay Area, Lisa will be speaking tomorrow, Thursday at 5:30 p.m. at Book Passage in the San Francisco Ferry Building. Hi, Lisa. Congratulations on your new book. And thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much, Rose. It's an honor to be on your show and have the chance to speak with your listeners.
Well, it's an honor to have you. Lisa, we started this series, The Authoritarian Playbook, because we saw a need to focus on Trump's authoritarian policies, put them in historical context, and then find out how people are responding. And I just wonder, do you think major media outlets are meeting this moment?
I think that in many ways they're not. They're covering the talking points rather than what's actually happening on the ground. We're not seeing the type of coverage about what happened in Chicago when government agents, you know, helicoptered on top of a building and took people out of their homes, zip-tied them on the streets. That sort of thing should be covered repeatedly. We're not seeing, I think, really accurate coverage about what's happening in Portland, for example, with how peaceful these protests and dance routines and flower distribution, et cetera, are. You know, we're seeing a lot of coverage of rhetoric coming from the White House. And I also think that there's just, it's just not one more day in the news. These are unprecedented times and they require a different type of coverage than just business as usual, which we've seen from a number of the outlets.
I was also surprised that what happened in Chicago didn't get wider coverage. And again, for people who are not following this, I'm just reading from CNN now. So this happened at a South Shore apartment complex. It was a large-scale ICE raid on September 30th. Tenants there said it appears everyone in the building was detained by federal officers, including U.S. citizens. Per Tissue Fisher, who lives in the building, told CNN affiliate WLS, "It was scary because I had never had a gun in my face. They asked my name, my date of birth, and asked me, did I have any warrants? And I told them, no, I didn't." So that's the footage of this was horrific, Lisa. But then also you have to wonder about the legality of all of this.
Well, that's right. You know, under our Constitution, under the Fourth Amendment, they're supposed to have a warrant from a court before you search someone's home, before you seize them. There has to be a warrant based on probable cause of a crime. ICE has operated in this arena of civil violations of civil law, And so it has it's not supposed to behave in this way. We're not used to seeing these sorts of law enforcement tactics of what are really arrests, seizures, searches being done by ICE in this highly militarized way outside of the rules that would govern actions by law enforcement. No police station in Chicago would have been able to get a warrant to search every single home in an entire apartment building. That's just not how it works in America. That's not how it's supposed to work. And so I anticipate that there will be litigation coming out of this extraordinary action in Chicago. But of course, Trump and his key leaders are acting like they can act with impunity and not follow rules. There have been obviously there's a history of workplace raids, for example, where ICE will come to a workplace with, information that they're looking for a particular person or particular people. That's obviously been escalated with the type of weaponry we've seen deployed, the types of tactics we've seen deployed by this administration. So it's an escalation of some practices that I think were problematic before now, but are now on steroids.
It's also important because things are moving so fast to remind listeners about the recent Supreme Court ruling that granted the federal government's request to pause a court order that prohibited federal agencies from continuing their raids in Los Angeles. And I'm just reading from the ACLU. The 6-3 decision, which provided no reasoning, reverses a ruling from two lower courts that bars immigration agents from stopping individuals without reasonable suspicion and from relying solely on four factors, alone or in combination, including apparent race or ethnicity, speaking Spanish or English with an accent, presence in a particular location like a bus stop, a car wash, or agricultural site, or the type of work a person does.
I mean, it is really an outrageous, that was an outrageous edict by this Roberts Court, by the court that John Roberts helms. As you say, it was issued without explanation, without describing how those lower courts supposedly got the law wrong. They didn't. Those lower court rulings were well grounded in facts, well grounded in law. The idea that you have to have reasonable suspicion to stop someone is long, a long-standing part of U.S. law, and also the notion that you cannot stop someone just based on their appearance or the language they're speaking. I mean, this is racial profiling, and these stops have been dubbed Kavanaugh stops because Brett Kavanaugh tried briefly to justify them, although there was no opinion by the court. The reality is, in America, we are a diverse nation. Nearly 70 million Americans are Latino, Hispanic, and origin under according to our census. Millions and millions of Americans speak Spanish as well as English. The idea that you can stop someone based on their appearance, especially the way people are being stopped, and in fact, not just stopped, seized. We've seen citizens, lawful permanent residents, immigrants with visas, people without papers, seized without predicate. The only predicate being the non-predicate of their race, where they're working, the profession they're in. These are things that put every single American at risk.
Today, we're spending the hour with Lisa Graves, who's out with a new book called Without Precedent: How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. Lisa Graves served as senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, including as chief counsel for nominations for the Senate Judiciary Committee for Senator Patrick Leahy. Before we dive into your book, Lisa, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you got to this place? How did you come to serve as senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government?
Well, I would have to say that I was lucky in some ways. And I was really fortunate to have some amazing mentors in my legal career. And so I was hired by Eleanor Acheson, who was the Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Policy Development, which is now called the Office of Legal Policy. She was working for Miss Reno. She's the first LGBTQ out member of an administration. She was just and is such a hero of mine. She hired me as a counsel in that job, and ultimately I became Deputy Assistant Attorney General in that office. And I was a career appointee, and I worked on a lot of policies, including gun policy, as well as the courts. And then after Bush became president in 2001 and John Ashcroft came in, I was there for a few months as a career appointee, but I knew that I just could not stay in that administration to try to make them appear more reasonable than they were. Although now they seem more reasonable by far than this current administration. I left. I got a great job with Mike Dolan. He was the chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. courts, which is the part of the U.S. court system that helps federal judges, supports federal judges, and I was there for a little while, and then what happened was there was a switch in Congress. You all, some of you may recall that Senator Jefferson switched parties, and that gave the Democrats the control of the Senate. And Senator Leahy's team reached out to me that fall about becoming the chief counsel for nominations to help lead their efforts to try to protect the courts. And so I did that work, and that's how I first encountered John Roberts through his nomination. Through his paperwork, basically, for becoming a DC Circuit judge and ultimately becoming a judge on the Supreme Court. But since then, for the past 20 years, I've worked in the nonprofit sector, including on national security issues for the ACLU, as well as leading a nonprofit called the Center for Media and Democracy, which did a lot of investigations about groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the Koch brothers, and more. And now I am the leader of True North Research, as you mentioned, Rose, and the co-founder of Court Accountability, which is spearheading an array of really important reforms to reform the court and restore our rights.
You've done so much incredible work, also really exposing the billionaires who have been working to change the courts. Just recently, True North issued a new primer on the authoritarian infrastructure in the United States. You wrote this with Alyssa Bowen. Can you briefly tell us about this?
Yes. So what we wanted to do was describe how both inside the government and outside the government, there is an infrastructure that is pushing for authoritarian policies, policies that are not really tied in with modern American policies, legal policy, but that are really being driven in many ways by the way our political system has been so captured by some pretty regressive billionaires who have influence not just in terms of who becomes president, like Elon Musk spending so much money, more money than any person has ever individually spent to get Donald Trump back into the White House, but also how some of these other billionaires, including Musk, but other billionaires like Peter Thiel, have been spending to support organizations and groups. That advance what we consider to be an authoritarian agenda.
And you do such a good job of really following the money. And this also goes back to the Roberts Court with the Citizens United decision. And Lisa, in some ways, I'm afraid that many of us don't pay attention to this anymore because it's just gotten so obscene when you look at how much money is spent, not only on political campaigns, but even when it comes to changing the court. What would you say to people who don't really know what to think about money and politics anymore because it has gotten so obscene?
Well, I think that we can't turn away. You know, we have to recognize, for example, that Thiel really helped pave the way for J.D. Vance's rise to power. And what does that mean in terms of our policies? It means that a couple of billionaires have a really disproportionate influence on the direction of the country and on what types of policies are being embraced and touted, and as well as obviously who is touting them. You know, we've seen from some of these billionaires a real hostility toward just the idea of democracy, toward our fundamental system. We've seen some of them and the people who influence them in turn, like Curtis Yarvin, basically proclaim that we need a monarchy. That idea of some sort of monarchical rule in America is so antithetical to our founding, with our actually 250th anniversary of the founding of America coming up next year with the Declaration of Independence. America was built on the idea that there are not kings in America. America is built on the idea that we have checks and balances, that we have democracy, meaning the rule of the people, that people are electing representatives. We have a democratic republic where our representatives are supposed to represent us, the people who vote for them, and not represent the billionaires funding outside campaigns that dwarf the spending by those candidates. But that citizens' united decision that John, under the John Roberts Court has really been one of the key pieces of untying American democracy from the will of the people. No, it's not the case that it was perfect before then, as Justice John Paul Stevens wrote in his dissent, and Stevens was a Ford appointee. Stevens wrote, and I'll paraphrase, when the American people look at what's happening in American elections and politics, the one thing they don't think is that we need more money in politics. So he and others in that 5-4 ruling dissented and said that this decision was wrong, that it was going to be deeply destructive to American politics. And it has been, because without that decision, we would not have had the ability of someone like Elon Musk to spend in the ways that he spent around the 2024 election. We would not have seen the types of, now we've seen billions of dollars being raised by, raised both raised and spent by billionaires like Charles Koch, really trying to influence who wins the elections, who becomes not just president, but who controls the Senate. We see this happening not just at the federal level, but at the state level in state races for attorneys general, state races for the Supreme Court, where this money is being spent by outside groups. It exceeds the amount of money that is disclosed as being raised by a candidate themselves. The reason we have disclosure rules is so you know who's influencing or who might have influence over someone who's elected. And most states have limits on how much a person can give directly to a candidate to try to limit that influence. But now we're in this topsy-turvy world where the dark money, the money that is not required to be disclosed, that influences those races, is so huge that we are seeing massive distortion of public policy because of the influence of billionaires, particularly right-wing billionaires. There are more right-wing billionaires involved in politics than more than progressive billionaires.
And for people who forgot about this, the presidential election, $5.5 billion was spent on the presidential race alone, according to Open Secrets. And then there's a piece from The Telegraph about how the North Carolina Senate race is expected to become the most expensive in U.S. history. Benedict Smith writes, Democrats do not have a path to winning back the Senate without taking North Carolina. And Roy Cooper raised more than $14 million, the largest ever single quarter haul for a Senate seat challenger. Lisa, what do you think it will take to start to chip away at Citizens United and start to go after money in politics?
Well, I really appreciate you raising those statistics because we are seeing, and we have seen, individual giving does matter. We saw Bernie Sanders raise a huge amount of money from small donations. It's possible to raise a lot of money from small donations and really have that sort of grassroots energy, but it is hard to counter when a billionaire can write a $1 million check or a $10 million check or a $100 million check, or entice people with supposed $1 million lottery. Like Elon Musk did when that money was actually going to campaign workers, people who were not, random. But what I think people need to understand, and this is my point of view, certainly from my book and my research, that Citizens United decision was illegitimate on its face. That decision was a 5-4 ruling. Clarence Thomas was the deciding vote on that ruling. If he had not participated in that case, it would have been a 4-4 decision. And what happened was John Roberts orchestrated a second argument, oral argument in that case, basically to try to get the campaign finance laws that restricted this sort of outside money overturned, to overturn precedents and to block a congressional law that allowed just modest rules on if you're going to spend money around an election, we're going to presume it's to influence the election, and there are going to be rules for campaigns to prevent corruption. What happened was, right after that case was set for the second oral argument by John Roberts, Jenny Thomas, who is Clarence Thomas's wife, met with Cleta Mitchell, who was then not so famous, but now is famous as one of the Trump attorneys that was involved in the infamous conversation in Georgia, where Trump was trying to get the 11,000 votes, for the 2020 election. And Jenny Thomas then worked with Cleta to create a group to benefit from the ruling to come in Citizens United. Late that winter, she got $500,000 from Harlan Crow, a billionaire who was not well known at the time, but now is well known as the primary benefactor of Clarence Thomas's luxury lifestyle, based on reporting by ProPublica. On New Year's Eve, she rushed in a corporate filing basically so she could cash the check, the $500,000 check. And then just about a few weeks later, in early January, Clarence Thomas sat on a ruling overturning significant protections against this kind of dark money. And he had the audacity to issue a concurring opinion claiming disclosure would chill free speech, meaning money, to people like his wife.
In your book about these cases, you write, through action and inaction, John Roberts has allowed a culture of corruption to run rampant. For more than a decade, he's worked to stall congressional efforts to require an enforceable code of conduct for the Supreme Court, even though every other judge in the nation is subject to such rules. He has not taken any public action to redress the numerous investigative reports about the mountain of secret gifts and serious ethical failures associated with Clarence Thomas and others. What could Roberts have done about this?
Well, first of all, John Roberts has been an obstacle to the Senate in its efforts to have a binding code of conduct for the Supreme Court. He, for many years, has through his through the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, through his meetings with members, has tried to block or stop, urge them not to do so. And then ultimately, what we saw after those investigative reports came out. And there were concerns before, serious concerns that had been reporting early on about Clarence Thomas and Harlan Crow way back in 2004. So there were things bubbling up. But really, after that tremendous reporting by ProPublica and other outlets in 2023, there was a groundswell of energy for a ethical reform for the court to have it have follow rules, have enforceable rules, and just follow the rules on the books in terms of gifts and gift disclosures, but actually to limit those gifts, to have no, not allow these sorts of gifts. What John Roberts did was really extraordinary. First of all, he refused to testify before the United States Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, every year, typically, the Supreme Court testifies before the committee as part of its oversight function and about the court's budget. But Roberts claimed that it would be a violation of separation of powers for him to testify before the committee about the ethics issues that the court was contending with, that he's allowed to, in essence, cloud the court. And then what he did was exceptionally extraordinary. As the Senate Judiciary Committee in the fall of 2023 was getting ready to vote on approving subpoenas for Harlan Crow, that billionaire, and Leonard Leo, the man who has helped pack the court and has been moving a lot of money to get these justices on the court, John Roberts issued a statement saying, "We have an ethics code. It's not binding, actually. There's no enforcement mechanism." And he said, "Every member of the court," and he attached the signatures, "attest that they follow this code." Well, the code that he released is weaker than the code that actually applies to all the other federal judges in the country, and it's not enforceable, unlike the code that applies to all of the judges in the country. So he, in my view, was attempting to thwart that subpoena effort, the effort to subpoena Harlan Crow, the billionaire benefactor of Clarence Thomas and Jenny Thomas, and Leonard Leo, the man who has helped stack and pack this court, this captured court. So that's what John Roberts has did. Now let me just contrast that. When there was a leak of the opinion in Dobbs, the opinion that was ultimately issued to reverse Roe versus Wade, Roberts sprang into action and conducted an investigation using court security and an outside contractor to try to find out who was the source of the leak of that opinion. Where was Roberts in contending with these reports, these well-documented reports about the travels of Alito, the travels of Thomas? I mean, Scalia as well was on this gravy train. Where has he been? In fact, he has suggested that the court is not bound by the ethics rules of Congress, the ethical rules that apply to all government employees.
And we'll talk about the Roe decision after a short break. On today's Your Call, We continue our special series, The Authoritarian Playbook, with Lisa Graves. We're talking about her new book, Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. In 2002, as part of her work for the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lisa Graves evaluated John Roberts, whom George W. Bush nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Lisa Graves leads True North Research. She served as senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government. This is your call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call special series, The Authoritarian Playbook. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Lisa Graves. She's out with a new book called Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. And if you are in the Bay Area, Lisa will be speaking tomorrow, Thursday, at the Book Passage at the San Francisco Ferry Building at 5:30 p.m. Lisa, you know John Roberts very well because you evaluated him back in 2002 when George W. Bush nominated him to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. What is involved in evaluating a judge?
Well, in our vetting process that was for the Senate Judiciary Committee's nominations unit, what we would do is obviously we would look at the questionnaire that the nominee presented, where they describe their top 10 cases, they describe their legal career, and they list any writings or speeches that have been published. But we would go beyond that. This was early days of Google, a few years after Google became a word, before it became an empire, I suppose. But we would also do searches for any other information about those candidates, any other statements that they may have omitted. Looking through their background, trying to understand whether they would be fair, whether this person would be a fair judge. And we also, part of that evaluation process is a process that reviews the FBI files of candidates for positions of power that's, you know, handled by the clerks of the committee. And then we would prepare a memo to the senator and to the other members of the committee describing this person's background and concerns or, you know, non-concerns about them. And so it was it's a thorough process. When the Democrats were at the helm of the committee, we could take our time and really do a thorough job examining these candidates. When the Republicans have been in charge, they've been, you know, really moving these candidates through very rapidly, as we saw back in 2003 and in recent, you know, in this recent year, for example, which makes it harder to get those vets completed. But that's a pretty good thumbnail sketch of it.
And even at that time in 2003, you tried and failed to stop Roberts from being appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit.
Yes, I did. I was working to try to prevent him from getting a vote for the D.C. Circuit because it was clear to me that he, in my view, he would be a destructive force on the bench, that he was someone who was an ideologue. He cut his teeth as a Reagan revolutionary in the beginning of the Reagan administration at the top of the Justice Department, advancing, you know, efforts to try to block reforms of the Voting Rights Act and other civil rights. He'd been in the White House counsel's office for Reagan. He had been the deputy Solicitor General at the in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration when they were defending the gag rule and trying to overturn Roe and overturn environmental protections. And I used to joke that the best thing that ever happened to John Roberts was that Bill Clinton won in 1992 because he could spend the next 10 years trying to create what I called a talking points resume. So if he, every issue where we knew that he was going to be a doctrinaire ideologue on, he would, he had a talking point. For example, he would say that he helped a pro bono case on choice, but basically by being in a moot court where he pretended to be Bill Rehnquist. So he, would pretend to be a right-wing justice questioning the advocates, and that somehow would get him some credibility with some groups and some lawyers in town that he would be fair, when it was really all designed to help burnish his credentials to get him on the DC Circuit and ultimately the Supreme Court. And he was, in fact, nominated in 1992 to the DC Circuit, but his nomination did not get confirmed that year. And I think he was determined to get through the next time he had an opportunity, which was when George W. Bush became president. So after the Republicans won the midterms in 2002, those midterm elections matter in all sorts of ways. The Republicans put him at the top of the list to push him through to the DC Circuit, but he'd already been buttressed by the rise of these outside dark money groups that were agitating along with the Bush White House for his confirmation, because it was clear, in my view, that he was going to be the person they chose for the Supreme Court, if they had the opportunity, if they had an opening or two to choose from.
In the introduction of your new book, Without Precedent, you spend quite a bit of time focusing on the image that Roberts really puts out to the public. You write, "The image of Roberts as an impartial umpire proved to be persuasive and durable, but instead of being a genuine expression of his temperament and approach, it was a meticulously planned and effectively delivered public relations strategy. He presented himself as a dedicated institutionalist who sought to uphold American judicial traditions." And you write, "Far from being a protector, however, he's used his position as Chief Justice to orchestrate a pattern of extreme decisions that have unmoored American democracy from its foundations." And that was before Trump's three appointees joined the court. So can you talk about this, the image that he puts out, and what you believe he's actually doing to this country?
Well, that's right. He crafted that image. We know from subsequent reporting that he deployed the umpire image first for George W. Bush because Bush had been the co-owner of the Texas Rangers, was an avid baseball fan, and John Roberts was a finalist for that position with Judge Michael Luttig. And John Roberts decided that he was going to tell Bush that he was just going to be an umpire, and the umpire isn't the most important player on the field. And that's what George W. Bush remembered from that conversation. And that's why Bush says that he chose Roberts, because of that image. And then John Roberts deployed that image to the American people to claim that he was going to be a fair umpire, just calling balls and strikes. When I looked back at the Indiana high school records and his prep school, it turned out that he didn't play baseball in high school at all. He played football and wrestling. And it turned out that his coach had told one of the right-wing dark money groups that had emerged to try to push him onto the Supreme Court. Roberts's coach said, "No, John Roberts was a really he was a small linebacker, but he was devoted to studying how to tackle his opponents. That's the real John Roberts, the person who is this oral advocate, who used his oral advocacy skills in that public performance to try to persuade the Senate Judiciary Committee and the American people that he would be fair." But what he's done on the court is systematically to reverse key precedents and even landmark legislation. So I think one of the most telling examples and one of the most damaging examples of how he has been a destructive force is how John Roberts has arrogantly treated the Voting Rights Act. As part of the book, the work I did on the book, I really looked deeply into his actions when he joined the Justice Department back in 1981. It turns out that John Roberts, was given the top portfolio on the voting rights reauthorization that year, He had no experience in voting rights. He hadn't litigated voting rights cases. That's not his experience. He was a new lawyer. But what had happened was one of the most anti-voting rights justices in the history of the Supreme Court, basically, was his mentor. That was Bill Rehnquist. And the year before, Roberts clerked for Rehnquist. Rehnquist had helped issue a decision gutting a key part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, taking out the effects test, the testing the effect of a change in voting on Black Americans. And during his time with Rehnquist, Roberts, his fellow clerks remarked in subsequent books how close they were, how united they were on race issues, on issues of civil rights. And then what happened was Rehnquist called Ken Starr, who was then the top advisor to the Attorney General for Reagan, and asked him to hire John Roberts. And John Roberts was hired and given made the point person to defend that decision that Rehnquist joined that was attacking the Voting Rights Act. And so Congress was trying to repair that decision, and Roberts was trying to block it. He lost ultimately after spending hundreds and hundreds of hours trying to prevent the restoration of the Voting Rights Act. That Voting Rights Act was then reauthorized until 2007, which happened to be just in time, basically, for John Roberts to ascend to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was confirmed in September of 2005. When John Roberts had the chance to basically hack away at the Voting Rights Act in the case called Shelby County a few years later, he did. And what he did was he disregarded the findings of Congress. There were thousands of pages of findings, an enormous number of hearings saying that the Voting Rights Act was necessary to protect freedom of the vote in America. If this provision, this preclearance provision, which required states that had a history of discriminating in voting to get preclearance from the Justice Department, if that were repealed, we would just see an onslaught of voter suppression and voter restrictions. Roberts disregarded that in a 5-4 ruling. He decimated Section 4 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And he did so in a way that it was really unjudicial. He disregarded the lower court findings. He disregarded the findings of Congress. He substituted his personal judgment and really his personal animus for the law. And that decision, the second that decision was announced by John Roberts and the Roberts Court, Texas and other states that had been under the preclearance provision immediately pushed forward measures to make it harder to vote. Now, for the past 12 years, we've seen thousands of bills introduced to restrict voting in America, and hundreds of them have passed, including, in recent years as well, since the 2020 election, as Trump called for changes to the voting rights, basically to make it harder to vote. Although they say, they have this whole mantra that they use, but in reality, it's made it hard to vote. Judges have found that it's made it hard to vote. And that's not all. The third pillar of the John Roberts decisions that have helped undermine our election process is first, Citizens United, second, that Shelby County case, and third, the Rucho case and other cases, subsequent cases around the map drawing, where John Roberts tried to clear the field from federal judges, stopping hyper-partisan maps that basically make it harder for people to have actual representation in Congress and in our legislatures. And also, just last year, the Roberts Court issued a decision that allowed the bleaching out of the First District of South Carolina, moving more than 20,000 Black voters out of Nancy Mace's district to make it a safe seat for hers. Even though the court had held out the notion that they would block racial gerrymandering, now under the Roberts Court, as long as you're aiming for Democrats, even if it happens to have this massive racial effect, it's okay, which harkens back to the original fight that John Roberts was fighting for the man he stodged for his mentor, Bill Rehnquist, which was about preventing the effects of laws from counting in our democracy. So he has been, in my view, a deeply destructive force to our democratic process. And that has driven division, driven extremism, because if these members, some of these Republicans don't have to appeal to anyone but their party, if they just win the primary and then they have a lock because of the way the map is drawn, then they're not responsive to moderates, to progressives. They don't have to compromise. The only fear they really face is from a Trump primary, someone running against them further to the right than them.
Right, and that's exactly what we're seeing more of today. In your book, Lisa, the section about John Roberts seeking out and procuring a clerkship with the then most right-wing member of the U.S. Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, you write, Rehnquist was a racist who had personally intimidated countless black voters in the racially segregated neighborhood of Bethune on the west side of downtown Phoenix, Arizona, and he had trained other Republicans to do so too. Do you think this is where John Roberts' views on the voting rights were shaped?
I think that learning at Rehnquist's knee, at his side, really cemented the views he probably already had, coming from a pretty cloistered background, as the son of a steel executive living on the shores of the Great Lakes in Michigan, heading off to Harvard. You know, he came into that clerkship, I'm sure deliberately, and in fact, when he was working for the Attorney General, working with Ken Starr at the Justice Department, battling against the reforms to reauthorize that Voting Rights Act. John Roberts wrote to one of his other mentors and said, and I'm going to paraphrase, but he basically said how exhilarating it was to work for an administration that he could believe in and that was revisiting questions that had not been questioned before.
Can you talk more about this monumental Voting Rights Act decision? You talked about the effects that it had immediately. Talk a bit more about this, given that in California, we're about to vote on redistricting in response to what's happening in Texas. And, people like David Daley, who you cite in your book, are very, very concerned about where this is all going.
Well, that's right. So what happened with that Rucho decision, with the subsequent decisions, the South Carolina decision, with the decision in Brnovich, is this is what created the conditions for Texas to behave in this way. Basically, what's happening is at Trump's request, the state of Texas, the Texas legislature is working to basically make more hyper-partisan districts to so that Democrats cannot get elected in Texas. And they're doing so because the margin in the United States House of Representatives is so slim that if the Republicans steal 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 seats by redrawing the map so that Democrats cannot get elected, including African Americans in districts where they would otherwise be elected, then that they will have a cushion in the House so that they can continue to control it. They can prevent oversight hearings. They can prevent an impeachment proceeding. They can continue to go along with these, like the big billionaire bailout bill of Trump and other shenanigans that have really put, healthcare and so much more at risk. And that's been made possible by the Roberts rulings, which ceded the territory to allow that kind of manipulation that Texas is attempting to do. And so California's response is the only really reasonable response to the fight at hand. And this is my personal opinion, to have the ability to say that if Texas does this, California will do the same in order to try to protect the game from to protect the game from being rigged by Texas, from Texas from basically changing the rules so that Republicans are the only ones who can win those federal offices because the way the maps are drawn. So the California measure is a countermeasure. It's not something that California would do but for this circumstance. But the way I understand the proposition is written is that it only would apply if that circumstance happened, if Texas were to proceed. And it's absolutely necessary because otherwise there will be no chance to have any meaningful check on this president and on extreme policies. And you may remember that one of the first things that happened after Congress flipped in 2022 was that the investigation into January 6, was basically disregarded. They issued their final papers about what had happened, but then that investigation ended. And now this Congress is attempting to rewrite history, rewrite what we all saw happen on January 6 with the insurrection, the violent insurrection attempting to stop our votes from being counted. by that mob on January 6th, fomented by Trump. And we also obviously saw Trump pardon the people who were convicted of crimes related to those activities, but without having one branch of government, one part of government in the House who can act as a check, then the president, between his actions, between the actions of the Roberts Court in allowing Trump to do almost anything he wants, there'll be no check. And so having a check and balance is vital to our system. And also, I would say the other thing that happened back in 2022 was that the Roberts Court again tried to put his thumb on the scale of justice by allowing that 2022 election to go forward with maps that were flawed under the Voting Rights Act in Alabama and other states. And that's what gave the Republicans their razor, sharp, narrow majority coming into 2023. And so this court, I think, is playing politics in a way, partisan politics in a way that is unsuitable for a court. And it's doing so now we can see in ways that really help this president, help Trump. We saw this court stop President Biden from one of his signature initiatives from having a modest student loan debt relief of $10,000 for people who make about $50,000 a year. That was something the court forbade, said that he could not do that without congressional pre-approval, even though there was a statute allowing debt forgiveness in emergencies like COVID. But that's the type of intervention the Roberts Court was engaged in when there was a Democratic president. But with a Republican president and with these Trump appointees on the court, this Roberts Court is going out of its way to overturn well-reasoned, legally based, legally sound rulings of lower courts in order to mow down the laws and precedents that are standing in the way of Trump doing almost anything he wants.
And new ICE agents are getting student loan repayments up to $10,000 per year with a cap of $60,000 per employee.
Yeah, the incentives. So the incentives for for this rising authoritarian activity in the United States under Trump are going forward. And obviously, that was with the help of Congress. That was because there's a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate that moved forward a measure to expand the funding for ICE and expand it so much that ICE is now has now has more funding than the U.S. Marines.
We're speaking with Lisa Graves about her new book, Without Precedent: How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. In 2002, as part of her work for the Senate's Judiciary Committee, Lisa Graves evaluated John Roberts, whom George W. Bush nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Lisa, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you a question about Roe. And then the reform that you're calling for. It's important to note that three justices, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, were appointed by a president who lost the popular vote. And yet they made it possible to overturn Roe. And you write that Roberts has used his 2 decades on the court to pick away at the constitutional right to access abortion. You have a very long section about this in your book, but can you give us the thumbnail sketch?
Yes, Roberts, on some issues like voting rights, where Roberts can, tip the scale for the Republican Party directly, I think he has done so. That's what he's done through that trio of decisions, Citizens United, Rucho, and the Shelby County case. But in other areas, Roberts has taken the position that, in essence, he's there for life. So he's got decades to do, to change other rules. And he's been grinding down Roe since the very first term. One of the first things that happened after Roberts was confirmed and Alito was confirmed, Sam Alito was confirmed to the court, was that it started to begin the process of overturning previous decisions that were authored by Sandra Day O'Connor and the other justices on the court that had protected voting, pardon me, had protected abortion access in a number of ways. So for more than, for 20 years, Roberts has been grinding away at abortion access, but he had this opinion where he said, in essence, he didn't want to overturn Roe outright in Dobbs, although he would have allowed a 15-week abortion ban, which basically it would be, which is obviously in violation of Roe, which allows abortions in the first trimester of a pregnancy, and restricts the ability to restrict abortion until a fetus is viable, Robert said the viability standard he would disband with, and he said, but we don't need to overturn Roe in order to allow this 15-week ban, because doing so might jolt the public basically into action. So his approach in some issues has been to just erode a right, erode a precedent, so that people, basically don't get alarmed, don't get active and involved, which is what we saw after that decision in Dobbs overturning Roe, where Sam Alito wrote the decision, hey, accounting medieval, supposed medieval law and religious law as a basis for overturning Roe. People responded. People in red Kansas responded, in Ohio, other states said, no, we have a right to access reproductive health care, and we're going to speak out and vote, to protect our rights. And so, in some areas, Roberts has taken a slow approach, but still a grinding down approach. And in other areas, he's acted aggressively to aid the party that helped appoint him.
In our remaining 2 minutes, we're going to have you back, Lisa. You've got a major plan in your book for reform. What would you say is at the top of your list, and how would you get there?
Well, that's right. So, as part of Court Accountability with my co-founder, Alex Aronson, we have been supporting court reform, including term limits for justices, major ethics reform like Jamie Raskin's proposals on no gifts, Senator Whitehouse's proposals on this money that's surrounding the courts through these amicus briefs. There's a whole array of things we need to do, not just to reform the court, but to restore our rights, like the Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Act, and more. Those are detailed in my book, and you can also find more information at courtaccountability.org, as well as at we'll have more material as well available as these reforms are sort of moving forward, ways people can engage, can join in, sign up, and help.
Citizens across the board support many of these reforms. What would it take to implement them?
Well, we're going to need to have a Congress that supports them and a president that will sign them into law. And that's possible if we don't give up and give in. We know it can happen in this Congress with this president, but this is reforms that are necessary to repair our rights and to restore our country to have a fair court, not a court that's been captured by these right-wing dark money interests in order to erase our rights, in order to erode our rights. So I think that I think we're going to get there. We've had a lot of momentum, and as you point out, Rose, the American people get that this court is out of control, that the ethics scandals are a big deal, and that we need to restore our rights. And I think every day we're seeing more and more why we need to come together to have people who are more devoted to our rights and our freedoms in positions of power in order to protect us from authoritarian impulses.
Lisa Graves has served as senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, including as chief counsel for nominations for the Senate Judiciary Committee. In 2002, as part of her work for that committee, one of her first tasks was to evaluate John Roberts, whom George W. Bush had nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Lisa Graves is out with a new book called Without Precedent: How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our rights. If you're in the Bay Area, Lisa will be speaking tomorrow at the Book Passage in the San Francisco Ferry Building at 5:30 p.m. Lisa, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose. It was a joy to be on your show.
Thank you. We'd love to have you back. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.